everybody. This is Shannon Scott, your truth-seeking story host, and I'm coming at you from deep inside of America's most haunted city, Savannah, Georgia. And tonight we've got a very special guest for you, one Patrick Burns, star of True TV's Haunting Evidence and regular guest on all of the paranormal shows of present and past. Ghost Hunters, Ghost Adventures, and the list goes on and on and on. And of course, he is now in the seat here with me in Savannah. And Patrick Burns is now a full-time resident of Savannah and working exclusively with Sixth Sense World Tours here in the city. Now, everyone kind of knows me and my background of working in Ghost TV and Ghost Tours, but I consider my own standards pretty high. And I'm fairly snooty and snobby when it comes to who I think is in it for just the fame or money. And let me tell you, Patrick Burns passes all of my tests. This guy is as genuine and as passionate and as authentic as the trade goes, and is absolutely burning up the ghost tour world here in Savannah with his intellect and presentation style. There's nothing cookie cutter college about this guy. He is really a sharp cookie, and if you want to hang out with him, the professor of the paranormal, Patrick Burns is on top of the mountain anywhere, but especially now here in Savannah, and take it from me, no one else comes close. So a fine welcome to you, Patrick, and a real honor to have you here in the studio, as it were.
Damn, I'm going to have to let my head deflate a little bit here.
Yeah, here.
I don't think I've ever had an introduction like that. Wow, thanks, Shannon.
Well, you're welcome, and it's really, it comes from the heart, because I think I'm hard to impress, and you and I have a little bit of a history together in that before I really kind of knew you and about, let's say, your past of exploring the paranormal, you came out and took a ghost tour with me in the city, and I want to say like 2004. Does that sound right?
It was about 2005.
2005, okay. That, and now, correct me, just trying to get a timeline sense here. Were you doing Haunting Evidence at that time?
I was.
Okay.
I had just been cast on the show, actually.
Okay.
I had gotten the call to go up to New York City to do a screen test.
Okay.
We filmed a test episode in Central Park, north end of Central Park, where there had been a murder.
Okay.
Yeah, a cold case that was unresolved, and I was there with my other co-stars on the program, and we did kind of a mock first episode to see how the chemistry between everybody would gel, and things worked out. And that was about a week before I hosted Ghost Doc, our first Ghost Doc, which is our first paranormal conference. That was in July of 2005, and I remember I just gotten back from New York, and I kind of like hinted to a little bit to my attendees at the event. I said, you know, things are going pretty good right now, and there's a good potential that I might have a starring role on a big TV show on Court TV coming up here. And
you know, nice, man. As
luck would have it, everything just sort of fell together.
Everything fell into place.
Yeah.
And just to kind of go back for a minute, but when I was doing ghost tours in a house that I lived in on Jones Street here in Savannah, it was an 1850s house, and and I was aware of Patrick, and he came out and he took the tour with me, and I'm trying to remember the order of events, but it seems like while you and I were in the parlor of the house, we both saw, although I don't know at the time, we both knew that we saw this, but like a trio of orbs, which I became routinely familiar with in the house, like after you left. But when they came into the parlor, I think it was like maybe at the end of the tour when I said something to you, like, or maybe you said it to me, but I said, did you see that? And then you replied, I believe that you replied, oh, you mean the rainbow-colored orb?
Yeah.
And within that trio, I believe that you and I had both seen the rainbow color orb.
Yeah.
So do you think that was a gay ghost, or
was that, gay pride ghost?
Was that a roaring homosexual apparition?
Yeah, probably. He was flying his colors in the afterlife. I do remember that. I remember... gosh, we had like 30, 35 people there in your parlor.
Probably, right?
The whole slew of people for my tour.
Right.
And I remember we were at the we held the conference at the Days Inn, which became the Inn on Ellis Square, and we had to walk. We walked, oh gosh, I guess about 9 or 10 blocks down to Jones Street.
Probably did.
Yeah. Walked all the way Bay Street to Abercorn and shot down to Jones Street to your place. And I remember. Right. You just kind of gave me vague directions here. I was like, you're going to make a right turn on to Jones Street. I said, okay, what's your address? And you're like, oh, don't worry. You'll know my place when you see it. And we turn the corner. We turn the corner there on Jones Street, and there are all these candles. There's about 100 candles burning, going up the staircase. I'm like, that's his place.
I had spookified it a little bit.
Yes, right. You did, indeed. And I think you still had the bed made from the cemetery gates.
Yeah.
There, right in the front lobby. Which was cool.
Good memory. Yeah, that was about a year or less before the neighborhood decided that they didn't like me anymore, and I had to move.
That sucks.
But yeah, you know.
Know the feeling.
Yeah, they got a little snobby there. But okay, so we've got Patrick here, everybody, and we are going to throw at him a litany of questions. And these are really kind of aimed at getting to know who Patrick Burns is, where he comes from, what he's doing in town, what he thinks about, you know, just life here in Savannah as a person, and of course as a storyteller. But now, is Patrick Burns your real name?
It is indeed, yeah.
Okay, just checking.
Patrick Lynn Burns.
Patrick Lynn Burns, that's
right. Yeah.
And any relation to the Scottish poet Robert Burns?
You know, I haven't made it back that far. I've been doing some family research on Ancestry.com, and I know that somewhere along the line, I've got Scottish blood in me. Right now, all the Burnses that I've been able to trace back are in England, Wales, and in Ireland.
Okay.
But of course, Burns is a Scottish name, so I'm sure the clan came across over to Ireland at some point there. But it's really kind of fascinating on Ancestry.com. I'm going back, peeling back these layers, and going back further and further into my ancestry and finding out. Yeah. So
maybe,
you know, fingers crossed. We'll see if there's a connection there at some point.
Well, he was just a favorite poet of mine, so I had to ask.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this. Were you a little upset that Bernie Sanders stole the expression, feel the burn? I mean, do you feel like he took that from you and then modified it for his campaign?
Yeah, I know, right? Right? Bernie's a good guy. We saw his rally that he held here a few years back.
Oh, yeah, okay. So you didn't take the issue up with him at that time?
No, I didn't. I figured, you know what?
Let it lie.
We're going to let it go.
Do you think that you might adopt Feel the Burns? Which is kind of gross. You don't want to touch people's burns.
Yeah, my wife might have my wife Marley might have something against that. So,
okay,
you know,
okay.
I think she would be the first to respond and say she's the only one that gets to feel the burns.
All right. Well, I am just throwing some ideas out there. Now, where were you born?
The hospital was in Highland Park, Illinois.
Okay. No, Highland Park. Nice neighborhood.
Yeah. But I grew up in Wheeling. That was where my family lived for the first, I guess, 4 or 5 years of my life.
Now, isn't there someone kind of famous from Wheeling, Illinois? Is it Wyatt Earp or something like that? No.
I'm not sure.
I don't know why Wheeling sticks out to me.
Yeah, it could be. I was very young when we moved away from there. We left Wheeling, and then we relocated about a half hour, 45 minutes away from there, in a suburb called Cary, which is northwest.
Cary.
Yeah, kind of situated there between Barrington and Crystal Lake.
About
45 miles northwest of Chicago.
Yeah, so you're a real Chicago guy.
Absolutely, man.
You are. You remind me of Chicago guys, which is a good thing. Now, big family?
I'm the youngest of four boys, so kind of a mid-sized family, yeah.
Okay. And what did your parents do?
My dad was a commodities broker at the Board of Trade in Chicago for many years. Yeah, yeah.
So, like, you know, the fast talking thing didn't fall far from the tree.
Right, indeed. Yeah, dad I used to go down to the Board of Trade and watch all the action down there, and it was really insane.
You and I were kind of talking in the car earlier on the ride over here that you kind of vibrated a higher level. I mean, do you feel like because, let's say, being a city boy, maybe the intensity of that impression on you as a child, that you had a taste for the action? Like, it made you ambitious?
Maybe so, but, you know, the thing is, I didn't really grow up in the city. I grew up in the burbs.
Right.
You know, and Cary back in the 1970s and 80s is, you know, it was like, I think it was 5,000 people, and today it's probably 25,000 people now.
Fair enough. It's
grown in size, but I did feel ambition and a tug, and when I moved in, I actually lived in Chicago proper for a couple of years.
Okay.
And I definitely felt that draw towards the whole lifeblood and the whole vibe of downtown life.
Right.
For sure.
Cool. That's neat. Did you ever hang out at Medusa's?
Yes, I did. Many times.
Medusa's,
yes.
Chicago.
Yeah.
How about Wax Trax Records?
Wax Trax Records, indeed. I used to live right there on Lincoln Avenue.
What?
Yeah, man. Medusa's was about 7 or 8 blocks away. I'd walk there. I'd go to Medusa's. Medusa's and Wax Trax Records, probably the best record store in the entire city.
Legendary.
Unfortunately, no longer there anymore. But
are they gone?
I believe they're gone. I think they might have a new location someplace, but I think the store on Lincoln Avenue is gone. But
wow, yeah. I also hung out at Medusa's in high school. Us goth kids.
Yeah, we probably crossed paths at some point along the way.
Probably, man. I would have had like some sort of makeup and black hair and all that stuff. But I actually met Al Jorgensen from Ministry at Wax Trax.
Sure.
And he and I were pen pals in high school.
Oh, that's cool.
I have correspondence from Al Jorgensen.
That's neat. my brother used to be in a band called kind of a industrial techno band called Terminal White. And they opened for Ministry at a club called Exit sometime around 1984 or so. Yeah, this was before Ministry had really, you know, became mainstream.
Yeah,
they may have already had Every Day is Halloween out, but
That would have been 83, 84.
Yeah, it was around that time before they turned into like that industrial stuff.
I love Al Jorgensen. Yeah, he's a crazy character.
Yeah.
Well, that's neat because I'm really into that Chicago music scene. So, where did you go to college?
Didn't go to college.
Okay.
That surprises me. Yeah.
Being that you're so active, I mean, not that it's a downer, but I mean, no. I'm not claiming big things in college either.
Well, my parents, like I said, my dad was a commodities broker for many years in Chicago at the Board of Trade, made quite a bit of money in the commodities market and lost it very, very rapidly when the market sort of went south, as it were, in the early 1980s. So by the time I got around to college age, the money wasn't really there. I could have applied for, you know, Pell Grants and that sort of thing. But my grades in high school were less than desirable. So I wasn't going to get any kind of scholarship or anything. And I I'd already kind of set my career. I had my own career idea in mind. Like when I was in junior high, I wanted to be a radio DJ. I wanted to be a radio announcer, radio personality.
All right.
That's what I was originally going to study.
Well, I have some interesting parallels.
Yeah.
Although I was adopted, my father, real father, biological, was a disc jockey.
Oh, cool.
And then I, as a kid, man, I would build those like radios for Radio Shack.
Yes. Oh, indeed. The kits, used to do it. Your little AM radio transmitter would broadcast, what, about 15 feet or something like, if you were lucky.
Yeah.
But my brother was, he went to Loyola down there.
Okay,
in Rogers Park. He got a job working at their local station, and I got to go in and sit with him on a shift one night in the studio, and I was just blown away. I'm like, this is amazing. You know, it's like, here's, you know, a real radio station.
Yeah, man.
And I'm sitting in the studio, and that's what they're doing is going out on the airwaves, and I was like, that just had such an impression on me. That was about the time I was 10 years old, and from that point forth, I thought that's what I was going to do in life. And sometime in high school, I saw a commercial on TV for a trade school called the Columbia School of Broadcasting. And I was like, bazinga, this is it. You know, I'm just going to bypass college. I'm going to go straight for the jugular. I'm going to go to a trade school. I'm going to learn my trade, get out of school, save some money doing so, and start working radio.
Nice.
The school was very, very straightforward, though. They said, you know what? We're not going to kid you. You're not going to graduate from here. You're not going to get your certificate from here and start working in Chicago. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
You got to pay your dues in radio. You're going to start work doing farm reports out in Podunk.
Yeah,
you know,
I heard the farm reports.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're going to work your way up. And the guy that was telling us this, he said, you know, I'm working in Chicago radio, but you know what? It took me 20 years to work my way up.
Yeah, man.
You know, like the theme song from WKRP in Cincinnati. Town to town, up and down the dial.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is, what life in radio is. And so I never really pursued it very seriously because I didn't really like the idea of moving around a lot. And I did work in radio briefly. And my training, of course, that I learned being able to do voiceover work has definitely aided me in my work, you know, in television and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, because you definitely did your television bits that I can see how there's a relationship there. Let's see. Now, this is kind of jumping tracks here in a big way, and but did you come up in a certain religion or spirituality?
My I was raised a Roman Catholic.
Okay.
Yeah, raised Roman Catholic.
That's a very ritualistic spirituality.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I think it's beautiful. I mean, I don't go to church, but I mean, when I do sit in on the Catholic stuff,
yeah.
I love the ritualism.
Well, it was kind of funny because I had a in the 1980s when I was kind of after my brother had passed away.
Okay.
I had started to explore spiritualism, and I started absorbing books on different types of religions, and I was very fascinated with Egyptology, and then what I found was really fascinating. Having grown up Roman Catholic, were the parallels between ancient religions like the Egyptians and Roman Catholicism.
Yep.
And they're talking, it's like the stories parallel in so many ways, and I'm like, these are the same yeah. deities. They've just changed the names. They're talking about the same people, you know. And then the whole ritual of a Roman Catholic mass, you know, they anoint the candles, they consecrate they do the whole the whole nine yards. And after I started learn and study up on metaphysics and how Wicca and these different metaphysical based religions were, I'm like, oh my gosh, the Catholics have been doing the same thing.
Well, it's like when you look at the original authors of the Bible, when you're talking kind of Constantine and his crew, and he really kind of gave them assignments to look at some of that ancient past stuff or relatively ancient and kind of regenerate it,
which Christmas.
It became the biblical text in so many ways.
Christmas, of course, was the winter solstice taken from the pagans.
Yeah,
Jesus. I think historians are pretty much in agreement. Jesus was not born in the middle of the winter. Clues there. Shepherds out in the meadow, the flock wouldn't be doing that in December.
Exactly. Well, yeah, and that always kind of spooks us out because you're like, well, did they just really use that as a controlling factor?
Mm-hmm.
They rewrite the script to give us something fresh and new, but to really rule the people.
I've always maintained that.
Yeah.
I've always maintained that. I think that was my biggest turnoff from mainstream religion, is that it is hijacked for political agendas.
Kind of makes you less critical in thought, and not to offend anybody, of course, for their religion.
Of course.
But at the same time, it's a sensitive issue, but I feel bad because it does really make people afraid to question.
Well,
when it should be the opposite.
I consider myself to be very spiritual. I believe in a higher power.
Okay.
I can't put a face or a name on it because I don't know.
Okay.
Right? I have ideas. I have things I want to believe, but I have absolutely nothing there to substantiate them. When you see people that are they just hook, line, and sinker. They live, eat, breathe, sleep the Bible and their religion.
Yeah.
Scary sometimes, you know?
Yeah,
again,
sure.
Not to knock anybody's religion or their beliefs, but some people obviously take it to the extreme.
Hey, this is an open forum. I mean, I'm all about delving deeper and dissecting and deconstructing ideas
for
our convention.
Yeah.
As a friend of mine said years ago, and I didn't really think of the impact then, but she just kind of said casually, question all the answers or something like question all the questions.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So I'm all for that. Keeps us on our toes. Mm-hmm. Now, did you see your life going in the direction of ghost hunting or becoming, in that sense, such a recognized voice or spokesperson on the other end of that?
Never.
What's the journey?
Never.
There.
Never. Well, as we've already illustrated or talked about, I grew up in a Roman Catholic household.
Right.
Of course, my parents were well-meaning. There's no such thing as ghosts, and I was the youngest of four boys. So when my mom and dad would go out for dinner with friends on Friday or Saturday night, my brothers are watching Creature Features on WGN,
sure.
And they're scaring the hell out of me, right? And
yeah.
And of course, my parents are trying to bring me back down to earth, and say there's no such thing as So I was terrified as a child of ghosts, right?
Mm-hmm,
even though my parents were telling me that they don't exist, there was something there in the back of my mind that, there's
And you think it was the way they warned you? Like, you felt
maybe,
like they're, like, trying to hide something?
Maybe. Maybe, or protect me.
In a good-natured way, yeah.
You go into a bookstore as a child, and you see that there are, you know, books on ghosts and haunted houses in the nonfiction section.
That
was a red flag right there. My grandmother's ghost was seen in the house that she lived in when she died, that she died in, which was right next door to ours. A woman who purchased the house from us in the 1970s, she was one of our neighbors.
Right.
And after we sold our house and my grandparents' house, she moved into the house, and she walked, turned around the corner, or turned around in the kitchen.
Right.
One day making breakfast, and my grandmother was standing there plain as day, and faded away. They exchanged glances for a few moments, and then she faded away. And my mom, you know, she called my mom to tell her, I just saw your mom my grandmother saw my mom, my mother's mother, in the kitchen while she was fixing breakfast. And my mom, of course, is thinking she's full of it, right? And she describes what she's wearing. She said it looked like she was wearing a purple robe or house coat. And my mom's jaw hit the floor at that point. This purple robe, this purple house coat was my grandmother's favorite article of clothing, but she would only wear it for Easter, Christmas, Thanksgiving. Mrs. Darlington, who purchased the house, would have never seen her in it. And that's when my mom had to completely reassess her beliefs in this, in this sort of thing. And she's like, oh my God, there's no way she could have known that that was... So she made a connection there of something, you know, whether it was a residual haunting or an intelligent haunting is up for debate, of course. But, of course, that fascinated me when I thought about this. I was about 10 years old.
It's like, it's already taboo, and then you hear something like that, which is like on the other side of the spectrum.
It's like, not only do ghosts exist, Patrick, your own grandmother is apparently one, right?
Oh.
So it had a very strong impact on me, but I still didn't see me doing it. I was terrified, and I thought, you know, first of all, to do this sort of work, you've got to be a board certified parapsychologist, and you know, you've got to have a wall full of degrees from all these fancy universities. And of course, you know, today we know the exact opposite is true. There's really not very many degrees in parapsychology.
Right.
Duke offered a degree for a number of years, as did I think the University of Edinburgh is the only one.
Yeah,
they're the only ones that still have a parapsychology course or degree, but I didn't see myself going in that direction.
Sure.
You know, I was fascinated by the paranormal, but I never saw myself getting into it as something that I was pursuing. It was always a curiosity to me, always fascinating. But I was like, but that stuff scares me, man. How could I ever become a ghost hunter?
Now, how old were you when the grandmother stuff? Just so I'm correct on that, how old were you about that?
Let's see. We moved away from that house in Wheeling, where I first grew up, about 1975. And I think it was several years later that Mrs. Darlington called me my mother. So I guess I want to say about 9 or 10 years old.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Mm-hmm. And so, in that sense, because I think everybody wants to know, what was your first real encounter with something psychical of any variety that was, let's say, pivotal or the hallmark that... Other than obviously the grandmother story, but what really defined your future pursuits in these regards? Really defined it? Like, was there a pivotal moment, or was it?
Yeah, there was. There are a couple of pivotal moments.
Okay,
The most significant, the most pivotal one occurred at, I think it was 1995. I was living in northern Wisconsin at the time, way up in the Northwoods, with the cheeseheads, Yahee there.
Okay.
Lived up there for about 5 years. My life was kind of in a tailspin. It wasn't really going forward, wasn't really going backwards. It was just I was spinning my wheels, and I kind of took a little bit of a sabbatical up there in the Northwoods of Wisconsin for a few years to recharge. And I thought it was gonna be 3 months. I ended up being up there for 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so in that sabbatical of the woods, like, what were you doing work-wise?
I was working as a DJ, club DJ.
Okay.
Mostly. I did work in radio briefly while I was up there as well.
Okay.
But I was sort of a jack of all trades. I worked as a DJ, I worked as a bartender, I worked as a groundskeeper for a golf course for a while, you know, basically. Whatever was available, whatever kind of work I could get into. But the one thing that happened to me that really kind of set this whole tone of, as a paranormal investigator in motion for me. I was working as a DJ at a club in a town called Rhinelander, Wisconsin, and there was an after party.
Okay, so you were working as a DJ in the woods.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What happened?
There was an after party after the bar closed one night, and hanging out with some of my friends out there, and they were like, "Hey, you know what? Let's go up to the UP. Let's go up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Let's go see the spook light." And I said, "What? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Paulding spook light." I'm like, "What's that?" They're like, "Oh, it's insane. It's like down the end of this gravel road. You go down there, you park, and this light will appear at the end of the road, and it starts pulsating. It starts turning color. It'll appear. It'll disappear." I'm like, and at this point, I'm like, I'm already grabbing my coat. I'm walking for the door. I'm like, "I got to check this out. Let's go. We're going now, right?"
All right.
Drove up there. Gosh, and I think it was about an hour drive. Of course, everything up there was a long drive, you know,
out
in the woods. But we got up there. It was Friday or Saturday night, and we were not the only ones there. There were a bunch of like local teens. It's kind of where the local kids would hang out to drink and do stuff, you know,
yeah.
that they were supposed to do when mom and dad weren't around. But we parked there. I guess there were about like maybe 20 or so people there. And I'm getting out of the car. I'm like, Where is it? And the guy that drove me up there, he's like, "Dude, you gotta wait. It doesn't appear automatically." I'm like, "Okay." I'm just like really anxious.
Right.
And after about 5 minutes or so, this thing appears. This bright, intensely bright point of light appears off in the distance. I can't tell how far away it is. It looks like, you know, it could be a pen light. It's some distance away, but it appears, mm-hmm. And then it disappears. And then, as some time would go by, it would reappear. Other times, it would turn color. It might be red. And it just so happened, I had a small telescope. Like a small field telescope, like you would use for bird watching, and I guess if you're a peeping Tom, you could use it for that too.
Right.
I had this in my truck.
Okay.
I pulled it out, put the little tripod up on the hood of the car, and we're looking at it through magnification, about 250 times magnification, and the thing is even more intense under the light. It's this pulsating blob of light that is just stretching, and I'm like, "What the hell is this?" Right?
Yeah.
We leave, and for lack of a better term, this thing haunts me for the next 4 or 5 days. Right? I'm like, it's all I can think about. It's all I can think about. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday night, Friday morning. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Not the weekend. It's a weekday.
Right.
Night. And I'm like, I got to do it. I got to see this thing again. So I drive all the way up there, an hour away, by myself in the night, and I park out there. And I can't believe I'm doing this, right? Because I'm a scaredy cat, right? I'm a scaredy cat. And I'm like, I'm out there.
Facing your fears, yeah.
Right? And this thing is, the vantage point where you view it from is, the nearest town is like 10 miles away.
Yeah.
I mean, if something happens to me, I might as well be on the moon, right?
Yeah.
I'm so far away. And, of course, this is way before you would have, such a thing as a cell phone. This is like 1994.
Right, sure.
And I'm out there, and I'm watching, and I'm just exhilarating. The adrenaline is just pumping through my veins, and the thing appears. There it is, and I'm looking at it through my telescope again, and I'm like, "What the hell is this thing? What is that?" And I'm just perplexed, and I'm sitting there watching it over the span of about an hour, and then I noticed something happen. About 4 o'clock in the morning, it was starting to get the morning was starting to carry on. It was starting to get light out. I could start to see the first little inklings of the dawn approaching. And I noticed something else very peculiar was happening. The frequency the light was appearing at was starting to increase.
Wow.
Which is flying in the face of what I'd read about paranormal activity, where it peaks around midnight, dead time, whatever it is.
Okay.
And then it will slowly, start to fade away as the morning goes on.
Mm-hmm.
The exact opposite is happening here. And I'm like, wait a second. If I can hang out here, if this recurs at this frequency, another 45 minutes or so, there's going to be enough ambient light out here that I can look through the telescope. I might be able to pinpoint where this thing's actually occurring from, right?
Uh-huh.
So I just sat there and I just waited it out. And it's sure enough, it's appearing more and more frequently. And I'm looking at it through the telescope. And at one point, there was enough ambient light from the rising sun that I could make out the red lights were attached to the back end of a semi-tractor trailer.
Ah.
What you're seeing is a small sliver of the highway about 7 miles up the road. It goes around, winds through the woods, and then as it comes through, there's an easement that they cut through the forest for power lines, and I guess at one point in time, railroad tracks.
Probably, yeah.
Which is just, it just gives you this little tiny sliver. And you don't see it at night. You can't really tell it at night because it's so dark out there. But with the and I'm looking, and what caused the lights to shimmy and distort and everything, I could tell, like, you know, if you've ever seen swamp gas as it's rising,
right.
It distorts the light coming through it. And I'm like, are you kidding me? That's what this is? Uh-huh. It's just car headlights and car tail lights off in the distance?
Yeah, sure.
I'm devastated. I'm devastated at this point. I'm like, I'd been building myself up.
Yeah,
that I'd
sure.
seen something truly supernatural, and here it was, you know, some dumb...
An optical illusion.
Yeah. Some dumb kid who was in his mid-20s, armed with nothing more than a telescope and the common sense to wait it out until the break of daylight, mm-hmm. that he might actually be able mm-hmm. to see with it. I was heartbroken.
Yeah.
I was heartbroken. But after the initial sting went away after a couple of days, I was like... You know what? There's got to be stuff out there that is genuinely unexplained.
Out there in that area or in the world?
In the world.
Okay.
In the world. Actual phenomena that's truly unexplained.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what propelled me into this. So, yeah.
Yeah, man, you got invested real fast.
Yeah. I became an investigator. I debunked my first case, and it really just, the whole thrill, the whole obsession with it is what
Isn't
propelled me into it.
Isn't
yeah.
that interesting? The,
yeah.
The life path... So wow. And you know, again, folks, we've got Patrick for part of an hour here, and we want to talk to him all night long. But he's got to do a ghost tour tonight. So I've got to move down the list here. As much as I want to keep talking about that, but
I'm sorry about that. That story was kind of long, but it is
no, it was perfect, and I'm sure everybody out there agrees that. This is the stuff that we want to know because we want to get to know you and kind of where you're coming from so that when people are touring with you, you know, they've got some advanced idea of, like, you know, does this guy have any substance and texture? Let's see. So tell us about how the whole True TV and haunting evidence stuff happened for you.
Yeah.
You were I don't know who put that together or thought of you or whatever.
Yeah, okay. Well, that story actually goes back to about 1999.
Okay.
I don't know what it was. It was a couple days after Halloween, and something just kind of... I was bored at work one day. I didn't have much to do, and I was... For some reason, I just hit up internet search, and I started searching for Georgia ghosts.
Uh-huh.
And did a search for Georgia ghosts, and I came across some websites of actual teams that investigate the paranormal. Back then, you know, you could count them all in the
yeah.
entire state of Georgia on one hand.
You're
there was
right.
like maybe
You're
maybe
right.
maybe four or five. And when I clicked on most of their websites, most of them were defunct or no longer functioning. But I came into contact with this group based out of Athens, Georgia, called the Georgia Haunt Hunt Team. And I quickly, you know, signed up for their mailing list and started attending their tours, not their tours, their monthly meetings, going to events and investigations with them. And I was
and at that point, you're in Atlanta.
I'm in the Atlanta suburbs,
okay.
yeah, Lawrenceville,
okay.
Gwinnett County. And I was with them for about a year, and then the group very abruptly went defunct. The founder of the group was going through some personal turmoil in her life.
Okay.
That she just basically vanished. And meanwhile, people are like emailing me from the group saying, "What happened to Sherry? When's the next group meeting? When's the next investigation?" I'm like, I don't know, right? And I kind of made a conscious decision. at that point to.
Right.
Kind of branch out and start doing my own things. I founded a group called Ghost Hounds, mm-hmm. Based out of the Atlanta area. And being that the paranormal wasn't the sexy thing that it is on TV today,
yeah.
You know, this is way before the TV shows out.
Right.
You know, most people didn't even know what a ghost hunter was back then.
Yeah.
We kind of got in on the ground floor. And being tech savvy that you know, I was able to maintain our website, we started getting... media contacts
okay.
from the local media in Atlanta, the local newspapers and TV crews.
And at that point, you had a website, didn't you?
Had a website
because
yeah.
I remember seeing Ghost Hounds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We had a website, and we would get to, you know, summoned by the news crews to do the you know, soundbite for the 11 o'clock news every October. And what I started doing was every time we appeared on TV, every time we appeared in print, every time I did a radio interview. I would archive these. I would digitize them. You know, you had to actually digitize video back then. It was a big, big pain in the butt to do it. But I would put these clips, like, in real video, real media, on our website. And, people, coming to our website could see, our past media appearances.
Right.
I kind of put together, wasn't really that way in the beginning, but it sort of built this virtual press kit, if you will.
I was going to say that's very forward-thinking.
Yeah, it's
like you're really, like, journaling the journey.
Yeah, right, yeah. Totally. And, yeah. I'm also, kind of out there to, so that as people come across our website and find us, they know, hey, these guys are, they're serious about what they do.
It's not just like a little hobby.
No. Yeah. I mean, it's a hobby, but, it's a very, it's
yeah, no offense to hobbies.
Right, yeah.
But it was more than just a casual
effort. It was, I was putting a lot of effort into it, and I want to, taking it obviously very seriously in terms of what we do. And so I started putting these clips up, and it was in June of 2005, just before I met you, about a month before I met you, that I got a call. I was driving, I remember, and I had my cell phone, and I saw a phone call come in from area code 212.
Right.
That's Manhattan.
Yeah, good old New York.
I don't know anybody in Manhattan.
Right.
Like, oh, this is important. This is a big one, right?
Yeah.
This is. I pulled over. I literally pulled off to the side and took this call.
Okay.
And it was a production company based out of New York City, Departure Films. They said, we're developing a new show for Court TV. And what we're going to do is showcase psychics profiling cold cases. And I'm thinking, I'm not a psychic, right? I'm a tech guy. And he said, that's okay. That's exactly what we're looking for. We're looking for a technically minded paranormal investigator to kind of round out the show. Because, we can have two psychics on the screen that say, I sense this, I feel this, but doesn't really make for good television. We need something more, some substance. So what we need is somebody like you with your technical expertise that can, when the psychic is saying, I sense this, I feel this, you can measure if there's anything going on there environmentally that might lead to, the fact that, yes, there's an actual paranormal encounter going on there, to kind of give some credibility to what the psychics are picking up on. And that sort of became my role on the show. And just before I met you, I was, like I said, I was called up to New York to do the screen test. After that, we shot, two pilot episodes in October of that year. And every step of the way, I'm thinking, I completely blew it. This is it, fun run. I got a free trip to New York City out of it, but it's not going to go any further than this. And ended up getting three seasons on True TV by the time everything was said and done.
Hey, we'll take just a break here so Patrick can get some water. We'll give him 1 second. We'll be right back. So three seasons, and obviously... Haunting Evidence was really well received.
Yeah.
Had quite kind of an underground following.
Yeah.
And even kind of getting into the mainstream a little bit. What was the biggest, surprise for you about doing that work? What was one of the highlights for you other than getting to do more of it? I mean, what really stands out?
Well, getting to travel. Around the country and getting to see different places was definitely a nice side effect of the opportunity. People ask me all the time, gosh, you had your own TV show. That must have been so much fun. Fun's the wrong word.
Right.
Fun is the wrong word. We were dealing with the absolute darkest elements of the human psyche.
Yeah, I was going to say that had to be taxing.
It was. We're these are real life horror stories.
Right.
We're going to a location where a body was found, and this isn't like some horror film.
Right.
This is real life stuff. These things really happened.
And that's why it seemed the Court TV, True TV had a, where that real human drama is happening.
Right.
This had to me more closeness to reality and let's say the emotional side of people's tragedies than just sort of your average ghost hunting show in a spooky castle.
Absolutely. We were it was not so much a ghost show, it was a true crime show, true crime show, with paranormal elements to it and a little bit of ghost hunting tacked in. It was more about the psychics and what they could help law enforcement with, and then of course I was sort of there to validate the psychics. But people would say, gosh, how much fun was that? And I say fun's the wrong word.
Right.
I was very honored. I was very, what's the word I'm looking for? I was very honored to have had that opportunity presented to me. but fun, I wouldn't call it that. Felt almost, you know, kind of a sense of duty.
Yeah.
Because these families are, they're looking for answers, you know.
Yeah.
They've got a loved one who's dead or missing, and they're looking for answers. They're looking for anything to go off of, and, you know, we're tackling these cold cases.
Yeah.
And the cases we took on were, I mean, they were freezing cold. These are cases that law enforcement, in most instances, was just like, we have nothing to go on, and that's the reason we're agreeing to work with you guys, because we're at wit's end here with this. We need something, anything to go off of.
Yeah, well, that's what I liked about the show was that it. I mean, you obviously, I think everyone knew that you did everything you did respectfully, and you had that vibe on camera, which I think that's what's been fun about meeting you after the show is that you're such a not serious guy. I mean, you're a big brain, big heart, but it's like you're like the
polar opposite.
You're a funny guy.
My persona on the show, I've been told that, Shannon.
You run into that all the time.
Dozens of times, people would meet me at events, and you know, I'm like. I'd be like in a after party after the, you know, in somebody's room after the meet and greet, and I'm like drinking beer, standing on my head against the wall, and you know, just or we're like doing chicken fights in the hallway, you know, crazy stuff. I mean, I just, of course, I had to take myself very seriously on camera when I was, it was all business, you know,
that's,
and
we
had to be respectful to the families and our production crew. God love them. They were adamant about that. They said, you know, you got to realize many times when you guys are filming, the family is right behind you off camera watching you. So make sure you watch what you say and be very,
interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
many instances, the family was right there behind me looking over my shoulder. You know, I'm sitting at my computer console and 10 feet behind me, the family's hearing everything that's going on.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I do want to have you back sometime and talk more about the individual cases, because I mean, it's real tempting to get into that, but I want to bring us around to Savannah.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously you're here, and you really landed, like, permanently in Savannah when?
That was June of 2014.
Yeah, June of 2014. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, what stands out about Savannah in your mind, or sets it apart for you to want to be here to do your thing? And then, you know, was it just the closeness of family in Atlanta, or more than that, or all of that?
Well, I fell in love. I fell in love with the city. When I first visited, came to visit in 2005, the same year we held our first conference here. You know, I of course, we were based out of the Atlanta area, and a lot of people that were involved with Ghost Hounds back then were like, oh, we got to go to Savannah. And we came. I came down here with my group. I think in January or February of 2005. That was my first jaunt here, and I fell in love with the city instantly.
Okay.
I was like, "Wow, this place is amazing! This place is amazing! It's got the history, it's got the paranormal element to it." My ex-wife and I actually we toyed with the idea of moving down here for many years.
Right.
We went back and forth. The thing that really kind of turned us off was the schooling system. The public schools here are not the best.
Because you're a dad.
Exactly. I got two boys. Back then, they were in grade school. You know, of course, you know, most the better schools are private schools, but it was going to be out of our financial reach, unfortunately.
Yeah, you're right.
So it ended up never happening. My first wife and I, we divorced, separated in 2008. And then Marley Gibson and I, she and I got together, my current wife, she and I got together in 2009.
Right.
And we actually toured the country for about 3 or 4 years in our RV motorhome.
Uh-huh.
And we were going around, going to all these paranormal conferences, just driving around, living the dream. And then the events started to kind of dry up. We weren't going to as many events. The events that we were going to were not really getting our travel expenses like they had been. So we were like, you know what, it's time to maybe kind of park our wheels and kind of plant in one location. And we tried to initially do this down in the Florida Keys.
Okay.
Florida Keys, love it. You know, one day we'll go back, but it was not our time.
Yeah,
it was
sure.
Not our time. Spirit, was not, things were not working for us. And we had attended a conference in, I guess it was, the spring of 2014.
Okay.
And I was in upstate New York, and we were on our way back through, on our way down to the Keys. We were on I-95, driving south through the Southland, and we're going past Savannah. And Marley said, "You want to stop in Savannah?" I'm like, "Yeah." And she's like, "You want to stop and go out to dinner with Murray, our good friend Murray Silver,
right?
You know, seventh generation Savannian, one of our ghost stock speakers for many years,
right?"
I'm like, "Yeah, let's get together with Murray. Let's go take him out to dinner. Let's go meet him at the distillery."
So it's good that you mentioned Murray, because I'll be interviewing him
now. Nice little segue there.
Thanks for name dropping him.
You got it. We love Murray. Murray's amazing, amazing individual. I can't wait to hear that interview.
But yep.
Marley and I stopped here in Savannah, and we were kind of at a crossroads here. We were like, are we going to stay in the Keys? Are we going to move someplace else? Maybe Savannah, where we can be closer to my boys who still live in Atlanta with their mom.
Right.
Hadn't told anybody about our intentions about what was going on.
Right.
And we sit down there with Murray in the distillery, and he goes, "Patrick, Spirit is asking me to ask you, are you going back to Key West or are you coming elsewhere?"
Boy, that's a dead-on impersonation.
And I said, "Well, Murray, it's funny you should say that.
Yeah,
it's funny you should say that, because that's sort of why we're here and that's sort of why we're talking with you."
Right.
He said, "Yeah, Spirit told me." Mm-hmm. He said, "Have you thought about being a ghost tour guide?" I said, "I have. I toyed with that, doing that down in the Keys, but it didn't really pan out." He said, "Well, you know what?" He said, I've got connections here. I've got connections here. I'll put you in touch with who you need to talk to."
And right.
He got back to me a couple weeks later, and he said, he emailed me. He said, "This is it. Here's the contact info for Angela Lynn. She is your contact. She is your partner here, your ghost tour partner here in Savannah."
Right on, right on. Yes, of course. Angela Lynn is the CEO of Six Sense World Tours. So that's awesome.
So he kind of introduced us. We introduced her and got to talking on Facebook, and
the rest is history.
Rest is haunted
history.
Yeah, indeed.
Here I am. Okay, to that end, do you have a favorite spot in Savannah from the haunted perspective, and if so, why?
Yeah, Calhoun Square.
Yeah,
Calhoun Square. Not for the reasons that most people, you know, everybody obsesses over 432 Abercorn.
432 Abercorn House, which is notoriously haunted. But
it's an old Greek Revival mansion.
Yeah.
Situated on the southeast corner of the square.
So, what is it for you?
The square hides a dark secret.
Mm.
Square is Calhoun and adjacent Whitfield Square. It's the location of the former slave cemetery.
Yeah,
we have maps that indicate this very clearly on the map. It says Negro.
The old Negro's burying ground, the old Negro cemetery.
Calling it cemetery is perhaps being a bit too kind.
Yeah, sure.
You know, they wouldn't have been offered the luxury of a pine box. Even they were probably put in a burlap sack or wrapped up in linen and basically dumped into a makeshift grave very quickly with very little, you know, pomp and circumstance. They were buried out beyond the reaches of the city, and, you know, where they were far away from anybody's, occupied areas at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, as the city expanded,
right.
The city built on its dead
lives
up to its name, just paved over, built on top of these graves.
Yeah.
In my opinion, that is the most active location that I've encountered yet. I haven't been here quite two years, and most of my nights are spent leading tours.
It really does have a feeling.
I've had crazy stuff happen to me there. I had a rock thrown at me by some unforeseen force one night. If your listeners are familiar with what is called a doppelganger or a spirit double, spirit twin, my wife Marley saw my doppelganger there one night. While I was kind of showing some friends around, and one of our friends ended up seeing Marley's doppelganger. It's a story I go into more detail with on my tour, so there's a little incentive for somebody to take my tour here and come and hear the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey says. That place is insane.
And it does have some haunted structures around it with stories that are features on the tour, so that of course, you know, is great for people that'll be hanging out with
it's,
you.
It's a hotbed for electronic voice phenomena, EVP. I get EVP there I mean, and I've gotten EVP my entire career as a paranormal investigator. The stuff I get in Calhoun Square isn't illegal of its own. It's just unbelievable.
I've gotten the feeling from you reporting back that, yeah, there's a lot of stuff there that stands out, even in my mind, of the spectrum of things in Savannah.
Yeah.
Now, you having done tours now for a while for Sixth Sense World, has this added to your sense of the town or evolved or deepened any particular views on the paranormal? I mean, I know you just kind of spoke to that in a way, but, I mean, does anything else
come to mind? You know, the city, it's not hype. It's not hype. This is America's most haunted city.
Okay.
The experiences that I've had here in this place, I mean, I could spend the rest of my career in Savannah, never go anywhere else. The amount of activity, the experiences that I've had here in the short time that I've been here. Well, I shouldn't say short time. I mean, I've been coming to Savannah since 2005.
Right.
And it has never disappointed me. Right. I mean, people think it's all hype when you call it America's most haunted city. I can't compare it to other places.
I think that brings up the issue that I think that phrase speaks to what we are talking about.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of encapsulating and pointing to all this phenomena. And, you know, and just kind of injecting my own take on that. But I think within that 24-square paradigm of the city plan with its squares, I mean, so it's like such a composite of human energy and life and activity for so many years within such a small place.
Yeah.
And then the fact that you have so many buildings and other structures standing around that were the containers for all that life.
Yes.
I mean, it's...
And the death.
And the death, absolutely.
The graves. And every couple of years, they're going around, they're digging up the ground, they're doing excavation, and they're unearthing human remains.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing some... they're getting ready to put a new high-rise in next to Drayton Towers over there off of... can't wait for them to break ground over there, man.
See, you're right, because they did prove that the old Colonial Park Cemetery went under Abercorn and beyond, but they don't know really how far it went to the west.
I want to be there the day that they're breaking ground. I want to just like have a GoPro on a stick, a GoPro camera, and just see what's going on there.
Let us know. We'll document you doing that.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, that's good stuff. Now, now tell us about the tour that you're giving for Sixth Sense World called Savannah Ghosts and what it involves and what makes it so unique and what people can expect from it.
Sure. Well, the tour started doing it in August of 2014, and of course at its onset, the majority of the stories that I've been telling are based off of your original research, Sixth Sense Savannah.
Right, sure.
I kind of take people, the locations that I was sort of hitting along the way.
Yep.
Were locations that that date back to you know your original tour. I take people to of course the Espy House, Calhoun Square, Mercer House. You know, you have to do Mercer House.
Yes.
As iconic as it is.
What makes, I would say, I mean, because your tour is a field investigation oriented tour.
Yeah.
So what kind of equipment are you putting in the hands?
Sure. That's the difference is I get out there and I go to a lot of the locations that you initially did in your research. But I also tell some of the ghost stories. I share some interesting history and trivia with folks, and then I also break out the toys, the tools of the trade, and we'll work with things like the Ovilus, which is a talking box. It has a digital speech synthesizer built into it, and it responds to fluctuation. It basically turns environmental readings, like temperature fluctuations and electromagnetic field fluctuations, into spoken words. Basically takes environmental samples and turns it into spoken word. It applies.
That blows me away.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. Kind of a neat idea. Well, but basically it just takes these values, these environmental reading values, sums them together, makes an integer, a number, and then it says, okay, 544, pull that word out of the dictionary, right?
Right.
And that's how it works in its dictionary mode. And I'm quick to tell people, you know, a lot of it is just background noise. It doesn't necessarily mean anything, but you will take these devices into locations that are known to be active.
Right.
And a lot of times they will start to really dial it in and get specific. Like, you know, you might take it over by the Mercer house and they'll start to say things like murder, death, suffering, blood, you know, shooting, pain, sorrow.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the universe has a language.
Yeah.
And it's,
yeah.
And it is translating. And
so that's what sets the tour apart is that we, you know, we break out some of the tools of the trade and give, you know, people, if they're brave enough,
right,
a chance to interact with the devices themselves. And of course, then I do electronic voice phenomena. That's about 90% of what I do as a paranormal researcher these days. I have no logical explanation for where those voices come from to show up on our recorders. It just is, you know, and I approach this from a skeptical perspective, trying to explain and debunk things, and I have no explanation for where those voices come from.
Like yourself being, I think, critically minded, that's the stuff that has always stood out to me, the voice stuff, because some of that stuff just seems so dialed in, and then it also is creepy as heck, and it just some EVPs make my skin crawl up the room.
Oh yeah,
I'm telling you, like,
we've got a few of those.
Yeah. Right, you know, it's like, be prepared to have the hairs on your back stimulated by Patrick's tour. Finally, Patrick, what's your mission in all of this, and what would you like your legacy to be?
Wow.
I know, that's a big question.
It is a big question.
What is sort of like, let's just say what you're doing right now, where is this going to kind of evolve?
Yeah.
Do you have an idea, or are you just kind of rolling with it?
Well, I have an idea. I've already done it all in terms of the fact that, you know, I had a TV show, I have a published book.
Mm-hmm.
I want more of that. I would love to have another opportunity to appear on television.
Tell us the name of your book.
The book is called The Other Side, A Teen's Guide to Ghost Hunting and the Paranormal.
Okay.
It was co-authored by myself, Marley, my wife, Marley Gibson, and our good friend Dave Schrader, who's a radio announcer. He does a paranormal radio show called Darkness Radio.
And where can they get that book?
You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere.
And
or you can come on my tour. I'll sell you a hand-signed copy right there on the tour. Yeah,
I'm there, really.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a great-looking book.
Yeah, yeah. I have other books in mind. In fact, I'm working on my memoirs, sort of my whole experience right now. My wife has been on to me to finally start writing my memoirs. It's
going
to be called A Life of Haunting Evidence.
Nice.
And hoping to have that finished sometime here in the next couple of months.
That's great.
Hopefully have it out by the summer or this October, this fall,
the
very least. Yeah.
Very good,
so,
very good.
Yeah, more media work to be my legacy, I hope. And
keep adding to the canon of the universe.
Keep adding to the canon of the universe.
Yes.
And, you know, hopefully some of my techniques and ideas about the paranormal will be, you know, recognized and remembered.
Yeah.
After I've gone to the other side myself.
Yes. Well, isn't that great, folks, that we have such a storyteller in Savannah, Georgia, that you can have access to with so much street cred and real rich textured experience history in his life, and the fact that he's here in town offering this kind of vocation and work and entertainment experience to the public is just amazing. There's no real way to squeeze in everything we'd like to with Patrick Burns, which is why we'll have him back for you for sure. He's a complex and interesting guy, and we want to keep having him back, and we're hoping he's going to start his own radio blog here with the others in the Sixth Sense World.
I've threatened to do that for many years.
Well, this is us teasing you in.
Having worked in radio, I know the prep work that goes into it. I definitely couldn't do a nightly show like some of my contemporaries do, but maybe we could do something once a week, or you know, maybe once a month, or you know, do special podcast.
Your public demands it, sir. Now we're gonna kind of end on 10 questions that are real fast, kind of one word answers for Patrick.
Yeah.
The first question: scariest place you've ever been? What came to mind right away? Like in one
Queen
building?
Mary.
Queen Mary. Okay. Is there anything you wouldn't? Is there anywhere you wouldn't want to go back to? Or is that almost contradict? Okay.
No.
What's your favorite restaurant in Savannah?
B&D Burgers.
All right. What's your favorite watering hole in Savannah?
B&D Burgers. Both. Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Good.
If I'm going to split it down there, if I'm going to have a favorite watering hole, And restaurant, favorite watering hole, B&D Burgers. Our favorite restaurant, the distillery.
Okay.
Canada Distillery,
okay.
And Ale House. And they, nice. It's also a very good watering hole as well.
Nice, good. Favorite horror movie?
Favorite horror movie? Poltergeist.
Excellent. Favorite sci-fi flick?
Star Wars.
Who's hotter, Linda Blair or Jamie Lee Curtis?
Linda Blair.
I agree. Stephen King or Anne Rice?
Stephen King.
Excellent. John Carpenter or Alfred Hitchcock?
Hitch.
Yeah, that's tough. Well, maybe
easy. Yeah, okay. They're both up there, but Hitch, man, he just had them, you know, he didn't get into the gore. He had the whole element of just suspense, you know,
yes.
With the camera angles and everything. Master.
Yeah, it's hard to compare. But and then last one, Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of or Unsolved Mysteries?
Ooh.
I know.
Oh.
They're both such influences.
Gosh. I'm going to say In Search Of.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a toss-up, though, man. I could go either way with it.
Yeah,
they're awesome.
I felt the same way.
Both by Alan Landsberg, right? Alan Landsberg Productions. But yeah, they're both great shows back in their day.
Yeah.
I miss them.
Well, gang, you've heard it now from the haunted horse's mouth, Mr. Patrick Burns. Remember, you can catch his very specialized Sophisticates tour called Savannah Goes pretty much weekly here. And there's literally no one else who is more qualified to show you haunted Savannah than this gentleman. So come take advantage of this great opportunity and learn more at www.savannahghost.com. Check out the Sixth Sense World Facebook pages, naturally. And if you're ready to buy right now, as we know you're chomping at the bit, just call 1-866-666-DEAD. That's 1-866-666-DEAD. And ask for the Savannah Ghost Experience with Patrick Burns by name. And that's all the time we have. And thanks to everyone out there for listening. And please share this broadcast and tune in weekly with me, your story host and truth-seeking friend, Shannon Scott. Thanks.